Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com. Corient.com. Swimsuit? Check. Sunscreen? Check. Phone charger? Check. Don't forget to pack the 5-Hour Energy. It fits great in a pocket or carry-on, and the alert feeling will help you arrive ready for anything. Now get 20% off when you use code 5HETRAVEL at 5HourEnergy.com. Expires April 30th. One-time use only. Not valid with other discounts. Remember, visit 5HourEnergy.com and use code 5HETRAVEL to save 20%.
Hey guys, welcome to another episode of TFL Classics Podcast, where me, Brendan, and Tommy, we talk about some classic vehicles, and today we are talking about 10 classic vehicles or semi-classic vehicles that you can get for under $5,000. And I didn't want to just find the normal ones that you look for. You want to look for Miatas and you want to look for Corollas and things like that. But I wanted to find something that's a little more obscure, a little bit harder to find, and a little more collectible.
Yeah, well, I'll tell you what. You're never going to hear about classic Porsches on this podcast because this is not really our world. And certainly we can't afford classic Porsches. So we are talking about attainable classics, which are fun to drive, great to look at, or a combination of both. Maybe even a little bit of luxury thrown in there. And as Brendan said, some of these even threw me off my rocker a little bit. But they are pretty darn cool and vehicles you may not necessarily think about. So Brendan, what do we have at number 10?
So starting off at number 10, we are talking about the Pontiac Bonneville SSEI. There were actually two generations of the SSEI, both the 9th and the 10th. But today specifically, I want to talk about the 10th. So what we have up there is the 9th. So a lot of people will be familiar with that. But this guy is the 10th generation SSEI. And why I picked that one is because it's a lot easier to find ones that aren't fully clapped out in your price range. Hence, this guy.
Yeah, so this was built from 2000 through 2005, and it was replaced by the GXP, right?
Yeah, and the thing is, the GXP, they went from a supercharged V6 in the SSEI to a Northstar V8, a Cadillac-derived Northstar. And I know a lot of you started quaking in your boots as soon as I said Northstar, because those are famous for how they are unreliable and head gasket issues. And so that's why I'm specifically focusing on the SSEI as the one to have.
Now, this is a very interesting car, right? Because when I hear the word late 90s, early 2000s Pontiac Bonneville, my heart does not start shaking, right? It is not an exciting nameplate. It is a vehicle not known for being particularly sporty, but the SSEI was a fantastic option package that really brought the vehicle into performance level that made it into a sleeper.
Yeah, so they took that 3800 series V6 engine that was known for being super reliable and slapped a supercharger on it, giving it 240 horsepower.
Pretty cool stuff, yeah. And not only that, but you also had some slight handling improvements as well as some slight design changes as well. But you got to figure 240 horsepower, supercharged horsepower, in a front-wheel drive Buick at the time was pretty phenomenal. Now, I had a very brief chance. I don't remember this. At the auction, I drove a 98 SSEI.
I do remember that, yeah.
I had no idea what it was because I wasn't familiar with the car at the time, but I remember getting on the back straight of this little test track, hitting the throttle. You hear that supercharger coming to life, you get this fantastic whine, and it really shoves you down the track.
Yeah, and they did make it, as you mentioned, in the Buick as the Park Avenue Ultra, but the Pontiac was known for being the widest car in its segment, hence why they called it the wide track. And it was actually a relatively wide car for the time compared compared to, you know, like the Camrys and the other things that were in its class. And that also made it a handling machine back in the day. And not only that, but because it's so big, the seats are comfy and it's just, it's quiet to go down the road. But then when you put your pedal to the floor, it just takes off like a rocket.
And that's why I love them, is because they are so comfy. So you didn't sacrifice like the ride quality or any of the, what handling there was to be had by going with the SSEI. What you got instead was just a big comfy cruiser that made cool supercharged noises. So you would get the Bonneville over the Park Ultra?
I would, because the Bonneville handles a little bit better. So it kind of depends on what you're looking for. If you're looking for something that handles a little bit better, maybe slightly more sporty, I'd go with the Pontiac, and I personally prefer the styling of the Pontiac. But if you're looking for something that's going to give you more of a budget Rolls-Royce experience where you're going to waft along quietly and have a little bit of power when you want, you might want to go for that Park Avenue Ultra.
Now, we did want to actually back up our claims with some facts. So Brenda went out and found some ads for vehicles. Now, this is a dealer up in North Dakota, right? And it's got 192,000 miles, but it looks pretty clean. And it comes in with an asking price of just $3,000 on this SSEI.
Yeah, and you can find them under $5,000 with much lower miles. So if that mileage scares you, which don't let it, because these engines are actually pretty reliable. You can find them 120,000, 130,000 miles with, you know, recent services on it for under $5,000 all day long.
So now for something a little bit different, right? We talked about a comfortable, relatively high-performance classic, but the next car on our list is a little bit different.
Yeah, so I wanted to go for, what if somebody didn't want a comfy cruiser? They wanted to go off-roading, right? A lot of people know about the 4Runners, they know about the Jeeps, but a lot of people are also sleeping on the first-gen Nissan Pathfinders, which are a super capable off-roader.
Now, if you look at like the Gen 1 4Runners from the 80s, those are going to be $15,000, $20,000, $25,000, $30,000 in really nice shape, whereas a nice Pathfinder can be had for like $5,000 to $7,000. The one you found here in California is just $4,500, which is very, very affordable. Now, originally introduced as a two-door, but you could also get them in four-door.
You could, yeah. So in 1990, they switched over to the four-door. So basically, if you get one from the 85 to 89, it's going to be a two-door. If you get one 1990 to 1994, it's going to be a four-door. These were based off of the Nissan Hardbody or D21 truck. So this platform is called the WD21 platform. And everybody loves those D21 trucks because they're super reliable and they just keep going and going and going. And these are pretty much the same thing, just with a little more usability in the back.
Plus, I think they look better than the truck version as well. Now, you could get them with a couple of different engines. There was a base 4-cylinder, which was dirt reliable but slow as molasses at 106 horsepower.
Yeah.
Or you could option it with the 3-liter V6 as well.
Yeah, and those had 145 horsepower. Now, they're not as reliable, but keep in mind, you're getting the V6 from the Nissan Z back in the day. So some people take these things and throw turbos on them, and they can be pretty quick little cars.
Especially like in Saudi Arabia, you see these with like 1,000 horsepower going up the dunes. Pretty nuts stuff. Now, we actually own one. You owned one.
Yeah.
Ours was beige, and it was an automatic, but you could get them with the manual. Regardless of the transmission, they're very, very durable in the long run and super good off-road with a lot of comfort.
And to speak to that durability, this ad that I found, I don't know if you noticed, the odometer says 375,000 miles on it. Now, I know that's not the best deal for $4,500, but I just had to show this because I couldn't believe that something like this, and it still looks pretty nice, right? If you find one that's been well-maintained, don't worry so much about the miles because these are long-lasting vehicles.
100%. Yep, great choice. Not very fuel-efficient. Now, by the 90s, they were kind of criticized for being a little bit antiquated and very unfuel-efficient. We're talking like 15 mpg-ish with the V6, and considering you only were developing like 150 horsepower, it's not a lot.
Yeah, and that just kind of goes to show you, the cars that we kind of lambast today as being old-fashioned, right, tend to later on end up being future classics. I mean, think about like the Ford Crown Vic. You know, near the end of its line, people were criticizing that for how old of a design it was. But now that it's gone and you can no longer get a new one, everybody wants one, right?
So next up on our list, now for something completely different, we're going across the pond to a country known for their high-performance cars. You hear the three letters AMG, and you're probably thinking of some of the new Mercedes high-performance models that are going to be $100,000, $150,000. Well, certain AMG models can be had for five, maybe a little bit more, right?
Yeah, so these are going to be a little bit harder to find on our list. This is In fact, the only one I could find in the country under $5,000, but they can be had if you're a little bit patient and you're a little bit determined and maybe willing to travel to somewhere that's not near your locale. You can find these E55 AMGs, and this is, we're talking specifically about the W210 platform, because they have those two round headlights on the front, and I think it kind of mixes the best of classic Mercedes with a little bit of modern Mercedes.
So the one we're looking at, $4,000. Now there's one in Denver. I see a lot of them for like $8,000, $7,000 to $8,000, but these are really potent, long-lasting vehicles. Now, the W210 replaced the really squared-off W124 Mercedes.
Yep.
And they did have a little bit of shift in mentality at Mercedes, because they were just losing money hand over fist because their cars never died. So they kind of went a little bit more toward cost-cutting. This was the era where we started to see a lot of rust issues, especially in some of the early 210s, right? We started to see a lot of kind of harder, cheaper plastic in these cars. But as much as they were lambasted and disliked, they actually have provided a lot of long, durable transportation for a lot of folks. And the E55 specifically has a really durable engine. So what's the horsepower?
Yeah, so these had a 5.4 liter V8 pumping out 349 horsepower and 391 pound-feet of torque. And keep in mind, this was the late 90s. They were putting out almost 400 pound-feet of torque in this machine. And it was selling for $70,000. So you're talking about quite a bit of depreciation to be able to get into one for $5,000 nowadays. And its competitor back in the day was the BMW M5, just like it is nowadays, right? Those M5s, however, have caught on. Everybody wants one. They're going for $20,000-$30,000 plus for a nice one. But you can find these E55 AMGs for still a relatively affordable price.
I want to say that would have been, what, the E39 series of M5, right?
Yeah.
Which are, like you mentioned, it's ridiculously expensive. And I think part of that, too, is they were a little bit more of a performance machine,
sure.
Especially in terms of handling, manual transmission, right? You had that screaming exhaust note. The E55 is a little bit more of like a straight line performer. Didn't quite have the same handling dynamics. Certainly didn't have the manual. I think it was 5-speed automatic only in the States, at least.
Yeah. Well, and keep in mind, for manufacturers, if you want your car to become a future collectible,
stick a manual, yeah.
Put a manual in there, because later on down the road, it's going to be way more desirable.
But I would bet, even though, so like a good E39 now is going to run you $30,000, right?
Yeah.
Upwards, $40,000. Whereas this is going to run you $5,000 to $10,000. This is probably going to be more reliable in the long run, because these are just kind of tanks. Also, shout out to the ML55 AMG.
Yeah,
if you want absolutely. An SUV, four-wheel drive, also same engine, really good.
Yeah, and so I wanted to talk about why certain cars get that unreliable moniker.
Are we taking a tangent
here? We're taking a little tangent here, because you know how you mentioned these were thought of as a less reliable Mercedes than some of the earlier ones. And a lot of people think of certain cars when they think of unreliability. Like we talked about before, the Passat W8, for example, got this reputation early on as an unreliable vehicle. And nowadays, if you join like an owner's group, which I did when I did own one, you'll see that there are a lot of them out there that still have 200,000-300,000 miles on them, and they're running great with proper maintenance. But people still parrot that old-fashioned talking point, even though they have no experience with the cars. They're just parroting what they've heard from somebody else, and that person heard it from somebody else, and they just keep saying the same thing over and over about unreliability.
That's interesting. Now, so I think part of the reason that certain cars get that reputation is that there may be a fatal flaw in either a design aspect or maybe a not-so-fatal flaw in a part that just continues to fail, right? And it's that one issue that kind of cements the reputation of the vehicle, even if the rest of the car was okay, right? So, like, for example, BMW 335s from, like, the late 2000s, those engines will go hundreds of thousands of miles. The bottom ends are super strong. The valve trains are okay, but, like, they had issues with the high-pressure fuel pumps and turbos. And those two things will fail, and they will continue to fail, but that really led the car to get a reputation for unreliability. We see that a lot with some of the older Mini products too, right? So it's not that they're unwarranted. It's just that there's certain items which have become known failure points over the years. And oftentimes, once those are addressed, the rest of the car can be more reliable. Now, the question is, how many failure points are there? So, right. For example, like the Audi Allroad, the first generation Allroad, the C5, fantastic car, right, to look at. But you had failure points in not only the suspension, which had 100% failure rate, but you also had issues with the turbochargers on the 2.7 twin turbo. You had transmission issues. And these were issues that were so unbelievably and ungodly expensive to fix that the car's reputation was cemented. And then you start talking about electrical issues too, which are a little bit harder. Now, a lot of the reason that people get this evidence right is just anecdotal.
Exactly. Yeah, like, and that's my main point that I wanted to make on this too is don't just take that moniker of, oh, this car is unreliable, and discount it completely from what you're looking for. Because if a car has been properly maintained and it's still on the road after 20, 30 years and it's running good when you go and look at it, it's generally probably going to be fairly reliable for you, because a lot of the unreliability of these cars came early on in their ownership and they got that reputation early on. So the cars that are still on the road today tend to actually be pretty good cars to buy.
Well, the question you have to ask yourself there is, like, how much maintenance is, like, an acceptable amount of maintenance? Like, sure, an 80 series Land Cruiser will go 200,000 miles with no maintenance, whereas a BMW X5 EE, the first gen, would go 200,000 miles with some more maintenance, right? And if that's kept up on, then it's okay. It's deferred maintenance that kills you. The other thing I want to talk about is certain brands have a reputation. So, like, let's take Land Rover.
Yeah.
And a lot of that was cemented in reality. So for, like, a Discovery 2 had head gaskets that would fail, which would overheat the engine, slip the cylinder liners out of the aluminum block. And if that didn't fail, you had issues with the drive shafts exploding and taking out the transmission. And there were just, like, known issues that made them very expensive to keep on the road. But then from 06 through 09, Land Rover had a model called the LR3. And specifically those 3-4 years are extremely reliable. The engines were good. The drivetrains were good. They had a couple issues with the air suspension, which were addressed for pretty cheap. And they will go and go and go. And then later on, they had more issues. So it's also worth noting that not everything from Land Rover has that horrible reputation. There are models that are good. You just have to do your research and find those models.
Absolutely. And it goes the same with just about any manufacturer, right? It's, you know, more modern BMWs are less reliable than old BMWs, but you'll hear some people say, like, oh, a BMW is unreliable. But you can find actually really good BMWs out there, for example.
Sure, 100%.
Yeah. But anyway, sorry. No, sorry to go off on a tangent.
Well, let's keep going a little bit with our discussion, because next up on the list, a very affordable vehicle, and not a vehicle that a lot of people think are classics, but the Gen 1 Ford Explorer.
Yeah, and I do think of these as a classic. Like, these were only made from 1991 to 1994. They were based off of the Ford Ranger, which at the time was a pretty good little truck. And they, in fact, shared the entire front end, including the front dash, with that Ford Ranger. And these were just really good little SUVs.
They were. Now, this is a car that I think people don't think of as classics, because at one point, especially in the 90s, they built a lot over those few years where you'd see them frequently and every day, and they were used to haul the kids to school and the dogs to the park. But now they've almost completely disappeared off the road, so that when you do see one, you're like, wow, look at that, a Gen 1 Ford Explorer.
Yeah, in fact, the one I found, I mean, look at this thing. Look how 90s that thing looks. That is so cool, and you can get it for less than $5,000. I think that you're going to find that a Ford Explorer is going to be such a good vehicle for the money. It's so slept on. They're good off-road. They can tow a little bit. They're roomy. They're comfortable. You can get them with a manual transmission that's actually made by Mazda. Just, it's kind of hard to beat.
They're also very easy to off-road and to customize. You can get, there's some aftermarket community to make them good off-road. The engines also go forever. It's the same engine that you'd find in the Ranger of the era, which is a 4-liter, right around 155, maybe 160 horsepower, some of the late ones. But automatics, not so great.
Yeah, so I've had two. I've had an automatic, and I currently still have a manual version of the automatic. The transmission was starting to slip in third and fourth, but the manual is pretty solid.
This was also the first four-door SUV Ford ever built, somewhat sort of intended to be the replacement to the Bronco, at least the Bronco 2. And yeah, they're really, really good cars. And I think especially finding a clean one would be a cool little investment. You're probably not going to lose money at the $4,000 to $5,000 range, so I think it's a really good choice.
Yeah, absolutely. So now, taking a little bit different of a tact, I wanted to go, what if you were looking for something from the Asian market, something a little more sporty? Now, I'm picking the last gen of the Honda Prelude, the fifth gen. And I'm specifically picking that because these are one of the few Preludes left that are actually still pretty affordable. The earlier Preludes are starting to shoot up in value a lot, like the other Hondas. But the fifth gen Preludes are still pretty affordable, just like this one I found here for $4,000.
Yeah, front wheel drive, of course, which is somewhat derived from the Honda Accord. Now, what's the engine in this vehicle?
Yeah, so this had a 2.2-liter four-cylinder, and it pumped out about 200 horsepower if you got the manual. If you got the automatic, you were penalized a little bit and got about 5 horsepower less, but relatively the same power. Now, being a front-wheel drive coupe, Honda knew back in the day making something this sporty that it wasn't going to handle like a lot of the rear-wheel drive coupes. So they actually, if you were to get the SH model, they came out with this ATTS system, or otherwise known as the Active Torque Transfer System, which helped make it handle a lot more like a rear-wheel drive car.
Now, earlier Preludes could be had with four-wheel steering. This was also a much more conservative design than the previous generation. And there was a Type S in Japan, which had more horsepower, which we didn't get in the States.
Unfortunately, yeah. But it's getting to that point where you might be able to import one. But again, you're probably not going to find that for less than $5,000 would be my guess.
I think that these are fantastic vehicles, though. They look great. They're going to be dirt reliable because they're a very simple powertrain. You can tune them up. You got a great little VTEC engine. Yeah, it's a good choice. And I'm not typically one to go for late 90s Japanese vehicles. And even I think that that's pretty cool. A little bit of practicality in there. Not horribly practical, but you got enough space for some friends and activities there in the back. So, yeah, pretty cool.
Yeah.
So, next up. Now, this is something that we both have experience with, and we'll have a discussion here in a second. But it is still possible, getting harder, but still possible to get an air-cooled Volkswagen for under $5,000-$6,000. Now, of course, a Volkswagen built from the late 30s, essentially. Well, okay, there's a bit of a war in the mayor in the middle there.
Just but a little bit,
like,
yeah.
They built a few in 34, and then, yeah. Anyways, they built from, like, essentially the 50s through the 70s here in the U.S. is when they sold them. And, of course, they built, like, 21 million worldwide. They were everywhere for a long time, but they're getting a little bit more rare on U.S. roads.
Yeah, but if you keep an eye out, you can find some, like, an example I found here. That actually looks pretty nice. I mean, they have a million miles put on the odometer. I think that's just basically saying they don't know what the miles are on it. So for $5,000, you're not going to get a perfect example. You're not going to get the most desirable, like the 50s and the early 60s ones. You're going to probably get like a late 60s or a 70s Beetle. But they're still great vehicles. They're relatively cheap to buy, relatively cheap to fix, and the main reason being because parts are plentifully available, mm-hmm. and they're super easy to work on. Like I think you mentioned to me, because I have a clutch going out in mine, to remove the entire engine, it takes 4 bolts.
Yeah, it's pretty easy.
And the engine is out.
Yeah, I've had a couple of them. You've had your Baja now that you own. The thing about Beetles is rust is a big issue, so a lot of them get knocked off the road for rust, and then a lot of them are kind of haphazardly restored. Actually, mine is haphazardly restored, and mine was a lot of money. So they can be expensive to buy, especially in the convertibles, and then early ones with split windows and stuff, they get expensive. But they are fantastic cars to drive. As you mentioned, part availability, every single part on a Volkswagen can be purchased. Not on every single model year, but at least in general. You can buy the pans, you can buy the fenders, and the deck lids, and anything you could ever need is out there. Rebuild kits for the engine are out there. Getting the engines rebuilt is super simple. Transaxles are a little bit more expensive to fix, but they're just phenomenal things to drive. Not very safe, not very good in the wintertime in terms of heating capability. But the little life hack I would recommend is the least desirable of the Beetles are the 71 and onward. They did a model called the Super Beetle, which had McPherson front suspension, more trunk space. It looked like it was punching the nose a little bit, according to some Volkswagen purists. But the Super Beetles command actually less money than the standard Beetles, and they are just as good.
Exactly.
Some Volkswagen purists are going to probably start typing at me. They had the same engines, basically the same interiors, slightly different pans with a little bit more room, but they're a lot cheaper because the purists get all snooty about them, and you have just as much fun in them.
Well, and keep in mind, too, when you're buying a cheap Beetle, like, for example, I bought my Baja Bug for $2,500. Now, mine was not running for $2,500, and I've spent another $2,500 to get it on the road. But when you're buying a cheap Beetle, right, you're not going to get the most desirable one. But that's the whole point. You can enjoy it. You can drive it around. You're not worried about getting nicks or scratches or door dings because it's just kind of an old, beat-up little bug. But it's still a great experience to have.
And speaking of that, you have a new segment here called The Most Reliable Classics. And yours has not been very reliable. But I think yours has not been very reliable because of the modifications done to it.
Yeah, somebody modified the heck out of my engine. Yeah. I would assume it's probably putting out close to twice as much horsepower as they came from factory, or maybe just a little bit less than that. And it's left me stranded, I think, in my 1 year of ownership, three, maybe four times.
Although, let's be honest, probably two of those times have been for the same stupid throttle cable issue.
Exactly, yeah. For whatever reason, my mechanic just couldn't figure out how to attach the throttle cable to the gas pedal, and it just kept disconnecting itself. But it seems like such a minor little thing to break, but it leaves you stranded whenever it happens because you can't push the gas.
You also have this crazy roller-style gas pedal aftermarket thing. And then his clutch is going out as well, which is not a huge job. Now, from my experience, I've had two of them. I had a beige 71 Super, which was just fantastic, and then I have this red one, which is less fantastic, but really there's just so little to break on a Volkswagen that it's very unlikely that anything that will break is going to leave you stranded, which you have, well, except for your modifications, and cost you a ton of money. So, for example, there's no cooling system to fail, right? Because it's all air-cooled. Sure, you can overheat a Volkswagen and do damage, but it's somewhat unlikely, especially if it's well-maintained. The carburetor, you can buy a new carburetor for like $80, right? Alternators, super cheap. Distributors, super cheap. You get electronic ignition. Just like everything you can buy in a Volkswagen is going to be there at your door in 2 days, and it's going to not cost you a lot of money. Plus, they were designed to be very simple vehicles to not only fix, but also simple vehicles in terms of staying on the road. So I think that they are surprisingly reliable, but that's not the only reliable classic on the list.
Yeah, so obviously a lot of people will think of, you know, like old Hondas and old Toyotas as super reliable, right? If you want to go and get the Honda Prelude like we talked about earlier, yeah, of course, that's going to be reliable. But there are also a lot of vehicles like people are sleeping on. Think of like the first gen Jeep Cherokees. Those 4 liters, or pretty much any Jeep with that 4 liter engine in it, super, super reliable and bulletproof. And you can get, especially like the Grand Cherokees, for dirt cheap.
Yeah, those 4 liters are incredible. Also, some of the Nissan stuff, like the turbocharged 300ZXs are quite complicated and hard to fix. But like the earlier NA cars, especially in the really square generations, you often see them with 250,000, 300,000 miles because they're pretty simple to keep on the road. And you have that Japanese reliability from the 80s and the 90s. So yeah, lots of good options. Corvettes too, C4, C5s, Corvettes.
I mean, pretty much anything with GM's like 5.3 liter V8s back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Camaros, those were reliable.
Or you go Yukons, older, like the 5.7s. And then, of course, like you said, the LSs, right? Those are all super, super durable, except for yours, which has exploded the front diff.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, just recently coming back from Chicago visiting some family, was driving through Nebraska, and my front diff decided to explode, pretty much.
And your 2500 Yukon.
Yeah, my 8.1 liter 2500 Yukon. It locked up the front wheels, which also broke the chain inside of the transfer case, which then cracked the transfer case. So my vehicle is currently sitting disabled, waiting repairs in Nebraska. I'm guessing it's probably going to be at least a couple grand to get that thing back on the road.
But, yeah, it's a bummer.
You know, it's a bummer, but it's also a vehicle with 300,000 miles on it. So that front differential made it 300,000 miles before going. In fact, like I recorded a little picture of it going on to that 300,000 mile mark shortly before it died.
Before it exploded. Yeah. I want to give a shout out, and Brendan's going to roll his eyes here, but old diesel Mercedes from the 80s, they just keep going. They just are lovely. Also old Peugeots from the 80s. They're also very, very durable if you want to go a little bit weirder. So, yeah.
Of course, if you don't want a good driving experience, I mean, you could also buy a Camry, you know.
Yeah, sure.
Honda Accords. They're never pretty break. Reliable. And
yeah, this keeps going. All right, so what is next on the list, Brendan?
So number four would be the Chrysler Crossfire. And I know this is going to be a bit of a polarizing vehicle. And in fact, it was meant to be polarizing by the designers at the time because they took the inspiration from 1930s Art Deco when designing this vehicle. But this was specifically made from 2004 to 2008 and was a rear-wheel drive sports car by Chrysler, but underneath it was a Mercedes.
Well, yeah, it was an SLK. They had this crazy, like, silvery interior, which is pretty funky. Jeremy Clarkson famously said that the coupe looks like a dog doing its business, right? But I think you're actually pretty spot on with this choice because they are very cool cars to look at. Right? Not amazing to drive, especially by modern day standards, but they're cool to look at. They're convertible. They had an SRT version, which is going to run you more money, but you could get them in either manual or automatic versions, right?
Yeah. So the SRT versions were automatics only, unfortunately.
Oh,
but,
I didn't know that.
Yeah, but if you did get the 3.2 liter V6, which is what came in the vast majority of them, put out 215 horsepower and you could get it with a 6-speed manual. So pretty cool little car. And one point I like to make too is when this car came out, it was lambasted for its design, right? But you know what else was lambasted for its design is now highly desirable? Is the clown shoe. The BMW M Coupes, everybody hated them when they first came out, just like they hated this Chrysler Crossfire, and now it's a classic. And I think that these Chrysler Crossfires, because they're so unique and so different, that they are going to be a future classic.
You know, you might not be that far off. I can't believe we're talking about this, but these are pretty interesting designs, actually. They're just very unique. Love them or hate them. They're just kind of fun. I agree. And the one you found looks pretty good, 180,000 miles, but it's a manual transmission with the coupe. It's got the deployable spoiler. I actually like it. That's an interesting choice, Brendan, but I'm on board with it. But
cool.
The next choice, wow, what a vehicle. What have you chosen for us here?
So I wanted to go back to do an off-roader. I wanted to get something Japanese.
Off-roader.
Yeah, off-roader. Now, everybody speaks and glowingly about the Suzuki Samurais back in the day. Those are classics now. Everybody loves them. They've gone up in value. But a lot of people forget about the Suzuki X90, which is what replaced that Suzuki Samurai.
Yeah. Now, this was kind of a weird choice, but this was like a – kind of got a reputation for being a little bit of a hairdresser's car. But it was a convertible-ish T-top-inspired roly-poly four-wheel drive with an actual four-wheel drive system and a lot of 90s injected in there.
Yeah. I mean – if you look at the seats, like most of the seats on the inside are quintessential 90s. Like they just look fantastic, right? They look like the bus bench seat from back in the 90s. I love them, honestly.
So here's the thing. Like a couple of years ago, we would have put a Samurai on our list. Because a Samurai, it's a better four-wheel drive. It's smaller. It's square. It's bulky. It's got solid axles, right? It's very, very, very durable. But the issue with Samurais is they got expensive, but the world figured them out. So like a nice Samurai is going to run you $10,000, $12,000, which is what it would have cost new, by the way, which is kind of funny. But a nice X90 is not going to cost you a lot of money whatsoever because they're kind of just weird and funky and they fly under the radar. But finding one, I'm surprised you found one.
It's not easy to find them. So you're going to have to look, and you may not be able to find one in a manual for under $5,000, but they're out there if you're patient and you look. Now, these were a pretty short-lived vehicle because they were so weird. They just did not do very well for Suzuki because they took the Samurai and took away a lot of the practicality by making it a more coupe-like design. I mean, I guess with a T-top, but it didn't have a traditional hatchback with a rear seat. It was a two-seat only. And in turn, they only made it from 1995 to 1997. And this was based on the Vitara, which is also known as like the Geo Tracker underpinnings. So it was pretty much the same thing as buying a Geo Tracker, but you're getting, I think, a much more interesting vehicle.
Would you get a Geo Tracker?
I would. That actually, Geo Tracker was my very first vehicle.
Really?
I ever
it was a
owned.
Geo Tracker.
Geo Tracker. And 2 weeks later, I rolled it into a ditch.
Yeah, that's what happened to every Geo Tracker. That's exactly right.
Yeah.
I think that the X90 kind of got a bad rap, but it's a durable, fun little car, convertible, and certainly be the only one to have one.
Yeah. I mean, they weren't powerful. It's only a 1.6 liter four cylinder with about 95 horsepower. And the thing that I think is interesting is a few years ago, Motor Trend came out with a list of the worst cars made in the 90s. And this was number one.
Oh, no. You can also, I know you can have some pictures here, but the Vitaras as well, right? These are pretty darn good, too. A little bit more boring, but sure. essentially the Suzuki version of a Tracker.
Yeah.
But yeah, also very long-lasting and kind of funky now.
Exactly. Yeah, so if you want something a little more practical, a little more common, you can get these Vitaras under $5,000 all day long. And they're pretty decent little vehicles and good off-road, too.
Here, I think they were sold as a Sidekick, actually.
Oh, were they?
Yeah, I know. Okay. Eventually, we did get the Vitara, but I think the early ones are called the Sidekick. Okay, so next up is a car near and dear to us. Wow, what a deal you found on this. This is the E28 generation of 5 Series, so the second generation. Brendan's found one here for just $3,000.
That's why.
298,000 miles, Brendan.
Yeah, 298,000 miles. And again, I picked something high miles because I wanted to prove a point that these early BMWs are really, really reliable when you take care of them.
Yeah, these are great cars. Now, so the 3 Series version of the 1980s BMW is called the E30. M3s are $40,000, $50,000, $70,000. Hugely expensive. But even like a standard 325 now is going to run you $15,000 for a good one. Yeah. Even a 318, like a little four banger, is going to run you $10,000 to $12,000 for a good one. But the 5 Series, same generation of car, similar design kind of motives, are going to run you like, in this case, bottom end $3,000, but a really good one's probably going to run you 10 to 15, and then kind of a rare one like the one we're selling is probably going to run you about 20. But they're just such great values and very underlooked or overlooked.
Yeah, I mean, this is the second generation of the 5 Series, and in my opinion, it's probably one of the best looking cars that BMW has ever made. It's really got a unique design. Now, this is the American version. Tommy's version that we do have pictures of as well is the European version, so you don't get those same crash bumpers. These, if you are able to find one of the European versions without those bumpers, are quite a looker.
Yeah, they are, especially with the asymmetrical headlights like ours has here, the wider outside lights. These are just such great cars, and they drive great because BMW, they managed to do this, and no car has really managed to do this since, but they're so comfortable, and yet they handle really well. So like unlike the Bonneville SSEi, let's be honest, which was very comfortable, but was kind of like a waterbed
sure.
with a fat man on a waterbed in the turns. the E28 5 Series are tight. They can be made in the race cars. They handle so well. They had a choice of engines. This one, I think, that you found as a 535. Ours also is a 535. And then, of course, the M5s are really expensive. But automatic and manuals. Now, the one you found is an auto, which is definitely going to hurt its value.
Yeah, exactly. So for under $5,000, it's going to be tough to find one in good condition with a manual transmission. You might find some out there, but you're going to have to search really hard. But in autos, they're just not that valuable, honestly. You can find them fairly easily. It's just a matter of how well have they been taken care of, because that's the key, right? When you're buying an older German car, they can be reliable if you maintain them properly. Toyotas are reliable regardless of maintenance. Older German cars can be reliable, and you know, the other thing that a lot of people think or forget to think about is these engines were what made BMW such an iconic brand. These straight sixes sounded so good, put out a decent amount of power for how small they were, and were very reliable and easy to maintain as well. I mean, we just took yours out for a test drive, and man, I mean, that thing sounds as good as a 911. I know I'm kind of going off on a tangent there, but it really does. They're such a good sounding engine.
They do. Yeah, you're 100% right. And speaking of ours, if you want to buy ours, it's up for auction right now over at tflbids.com. So we are selling it. A Japanese market car, actually, brought to the U.S., converted to manual transmission. It's in fantastic shape, like 125,000 miles on it. So check it out over at tflbids.com. If you want to own a super rare, it's actually an M535, which they never sold in the States. It's a super unusual car.
Yeah, I think this, if you're talking about just the cars that are stateside, this may actually be more rare than getting an M5.
For sure, yeah.
Honestly. Yeah. I mean, an M5, you're going to spend twice as much money as you would on this guy.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, too, if you were to buy this driving down the road, very few people are going to know you're not driving an M5.
Because it looks identical.
It does. It looks so close to one.
100%. So we're going to finish it up with the car that I am very curious about, because I don't know much about these, but you put it on the list. What are we looking at, Brendan?
So this is one that I am actually actively looking for.
Oh, gosh.
A Buick Roadmaster sedan. So they made them in the wagon, and I know those wagons are super, super cool. But the wagons, well, people have caught on. You're not going to get one for under $5,000.
What does a good wagon go for, you know?
Wagons, you're looking, I would say, minimum $7,000 to $8,000, and some of them are even touching up into the high teens, low 20s nowadays, in good shape. But these were made from 1991 to 1996 in wagon form. But in sedan form, you had to wait till 1992. The wagons, another cool thing about the wagons is they actually had a third row seat that was rear facing.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, it was a little flip-out third row seat that was rear-facing that you could fold down if you didn't want to use it. But these were a rear-wheel drive boat on wheels. This was kind of the last gasp of the American luxury barges. And they were also made as the Chevy Caprice, you know, which is if you got like a Chevy Caprice SS from the mid to late 90s, those things are actually quite valuable and hard to find in good shape. They also came as a Cadillac as well, which I think you can find in that similar price range. But specifically the Buick Roadmaster, you can find these fairly commonly for under $5,000 still.
Now, are we talking V8 or V6 in this car?
So this was a V8. The first 2 years of it were just, you know, your standard small block V8 putting out a whopping 180 horsepower. But if you're able to find one that's a 1994 through 1996, which this, I believe, is a 1995, so it does have the basically the same LT1 engine from the Corvette that put out 300 horsepower in a Corvette. They just detuned this a little bit because they didn't want to make it as fast, putting out 260 horsepower. But a lot of people have said that they could easily get that 40 horsepower back in these things and make them into pretty quick boats.
So, it is very beige, the one you found.
The one I found, yes, is beige. They didn't all come in beige. Some of them even had like the fake wood paneling on them.
Even in the sedans?
Yep. Wow. I think so. Well, maybe I'm wrong on that. I know I've seen it in the wagons, maybe not in the sedans.
Interesting.
I don't know. Some of them did have these Landau tops, which are not great, to be honest with
not
you.
Great.
But the other thing that I think is interesting is you could order these with a towing package.
A towing package?
You could order them with a towing package where you could tow up to 5,000 pounds.
Oh, my goodness.
In one of these. And if you got the towing package with the wagon, they could tow up to 7,000 pounds.
$7,000.
And they did that by adding a 293 rear axle and a limited slip differential.
Jeez, dude. That's crazy.
Yeah.
So, towing rig here is what you're telling me.
Yeah, it's a towing rig. It's a soft, cushy ride, and it's quick and can peel out those rear tires.
There
How
you
can
go.
You beat that?
How could you not go with that? So yeah. Of all the vehicles on the list, which one are you taking home?
I'm taking home the Roadmaster.
If
I could just have the one vehicle, right, I'm going to choose something that I can take on long drives and that can also be pretty quick. And think about it. Those LT1 V8s, you can tune them pretty easily. Just like you could a Corvette or a Camaro back in the day, you could put the same tuning on these, except you've got four doors and a soft ride.
So why the Roadmaster and not the E55 Mercedes?
Well, I think because parts availability, honestly. The E55 Mercedes is going to be a bit more rare. You know, you're going to have something that people won't necessarily have seen before when you roll up in it. But the Roadmaster, the parts out there are plentiful. The cost of keeping them on the road is dirt cheap. And they're just a bit more comfortable of a ride and a bit more spacious.
The very interesting perspective here. So I think I'm going to go – you got to consider – of all the cars on the list, so I'm leaning Volkswagen, but it's going to be really hard to find a good Volkswagen for $5,000.
Exactly. Just think about it. If you have $5,000 and that's all you have to go out and buy one of these 10 cars, you know, what's the one that's going to speak to you? And you could only have one car.
Right.
This has got to get you to and from work every day. This has got to take you to see the family on holidays, up to the mountains. Everything you want to do with it, what's the one car you'd get?
You know, I think, believe it or not, I am going to take the first-gen Ford Explorer. That's going to be my choice. Yeah, I do.
That really surprises me.
Yeah, so you have one.
I do.
Did you sell it yet?
No.
Yeah,
it's just sitting at the mechanic, just haven't had him do anything to it yet.
I think they're pretty, especially in the two-door configuration, these Explorers are really pretty cool. And with the manual transmission, they're kind of fun to drive, and they have just the most 80s-ish interior. Plus, if I'm only allowed one car, it's going to four-wheel drive, so it's going to be good in the snow. It's fairly safe-ish for hauling folks and families and whatever. And it's going to be very, very, very reliable. So that's why – and it's going to be comfy too. And you just don't see these anymore. So I think Explorer is going to be – that's going to be my choice, believe it or not.
You know, I think that's a pretty good choice. I can respect that because it's a slept-on vehicle. They've definitely bottomed out on value. So if you buy one for – this one's listed for $4,500 – you drive it around for a few years, you could probably sell it for $4,500, maybe even a little bit more. So you're not going to lose any money on it, and you're just going to have a cool vehicle to enjoy.
So one other topic we should talk about before we close out, and you actually wrote this down here in the notes, how to avoid getting scammed.
Yeah, so that's a pretty big thing that's happening nowadays. I sell a lot of cars on Facebook, and you know, I buy some cars on Facebook, and it's pretty common to see that where you're going to get messages from people that aren't living in the country that just want to get your money and not sell you a car or not buy your car, depending on if you're buying or selling. And some of the common ways that I've found to distinguish whether it's a scammer or a true, genuine buyer, if they send you a text file that's an image, that's the number one thing that I'm seeing nowadays is they will literally send me like, I'm interested in buying your car, but it's an image. So it's not like actual typed out text. That should be a number one indicator of this is not a real interested buyer or seller. I have. Almost every car I list, I get one of those.
Wow.
Yeah. Another thing that I see is somebody that just messages you and then immediately wants your phone number without any context. Sometimes I will give out my phone number, but only after having like a more in-depth conversation where I can tell that I'm talking to a real person. But,
So that's selling a car. When it comes to buying a car, the opposite happens. So typically what I do is I'll find like this Explorer on Craigslist. And if there's no phone number, I'll email them and be like, hey, I saw your Explorer on Craigslist. I would love to chat. Please give me a ring. And I'll give them my phone number to make sure they're a real person on the other side of the conversation. Right? I want to make sure that the seller is a real person. I only deal with clean titles. So you've had some pretty good luck with salvage in the past or rebuilt, I should say.
Yeah. I mean, I've had, I think, two rebuilt titles. I tend to avoid those personally. If you're buying it just to enjoy it, you're going to save probably 20% off the cost of what a vehicle normally goes for. But thoroughly check that thing out because you don't know who did the repairs on it. It's a little bit of a risk, but if it's been repaired by a reputable shop, it might be a decent buy. But yeah, anyways.
Another one. I try to avoid cars that were just purchased and then immediately getting sold again. Like I see that a lot. Like someone will buy a car, clearly it'll still be on temp tags here in Colorado. And then that almost always means it won't pass emissions.
Exactly.
Because here in Colorado, you get temp tags and you go get it emissions tested and then if it fails, a lot of folks will just stick it right back online.
Yeah, that's a big tell. If you see temp tags in the pictures, run.
Yeah.
Generally. The other thing, too, is if you open the trunk and you see some bottles of fluids in there, that's a telltale sign of things that are going on. Like if you see bottles of coolant and bottles of oil sitting in there, it's probably got a coolant leak and it's probably got an oil leak. And that's why they keep them in the trunk of the vehicle. I mean, you know, you can buy some classics where they're owned by a 90-year-old guy that does all his own maintenance and maybe he leaves them sitting in there. But the vast majority of the cars you're buying for $5,000, they're not going to have that in there. But if it's in there, something's wrong.
And a top tip, and I think we both agree with this, Brendan kind of found these cars all over the country. You got to be willing to travel for some of these deals, especially if you live in the Midwest and everything for under $5,000 has no floors in it and no rocker panels. Like, spending the money on the plane ticket to go to Kansas City or to go to Kansas City, terrible example, to go to Greensboro or to go to Los Angeles and then road trip at home is always a good bet.
Yeah, and I mean, we live here in Colorado, and what I've found is in some states, cars are just cheaper in general. Like, I will fly down to Texas sometimes to buy cars because for whatever reason, cars in Texas are just cheaper than they are here in Colorado, especially vehicles with all-wheel drive. In Houston, They don't need that all-wheel drive, so I could fly down there, drive it up, and get a pretty good discount.
There you go. Well, guys, let us know what you think of our list in the comment section below.
Yeah, and thanks for checking us out. I've been Brendan.
I've been Tommy. Check out TFL Classics for more of our classic content.
Yeah.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.